This podcast is brought to you by The Province.
The Province Sports Podcast.
Welcome to Province Sports Radio. It's Thursday, November 9th, I think. We're going to call us, what are you guys calling us, the Willis Podcast?
I can't, yeah, because I seem to be the only kind of permanent fixture here. Our injury-prone news editor, Paul Chapman, again on the DL. People are starting to talk about his durability.
Yeah, you know, no kidding.
Means, but I guess so. This makes you the David Bremner of this.
Well, that's not too bad.
That's a hip reference for that's you kids out there. That David Bremner was the guy who always filled in for Johnny Carson.
So I'm Patrick Johnson. That's Ed Willis. Yeah, Chapman, high price talent, questionable durability. I'm sure he's listening right now, really, really happy to.
Yeah, you know. Only if he can pick this up in the hospital room.
Eddie, do you believe in the Canucks? 15 games in? 14 games? I can't even remember.
Yeah,
Looking good.
It's a really tricky one. I think they're making a more convincing argument this year than they have in years past. But we've also seen this movie before, and I really should have done more research on this. But going back to the Tortorella year, where everything was going great until right around Christmas, and then that was the sound of a toilet flushing a few people out there in radio land. So I don't know, but again, I look at how they're doing it, and there's nothing really fluky about it. The only question for me is, will their goaltending hold up over 82 games? Because as often as not, so far, they've had the better goalie on most nights. And Jacob Markstrom, big question mark. I don't think the question mark is so much the Markstrom-Nielsen tandem. I think collectively they'll be fine, but can Markstrom be that guy who carries the ball 55, 60 games and provides NHL-caliber goaltending on a night-in, night-out basis?
First of all, for clarity's sake, Ed is not on the toilet. That was just his simulated sound, just so that we know that, you know, we're a classy organization here. To me, the best comparison point at looking at this team and how well they've come out of the gates is to look at how it went last year. Mm. I mean, remember, they got those four fluky wins, yeah. Hadn't led for more than, you know, I think it was 10 seconds mm-hmm. collectively.
Yeah,
or
the Athletics people were like, their heads were exploding all over Vancouver. Yeah.
And I was enjoying the ride, but I was one of those ones going, how, you know, come on. But you look at this team, and I mean, one of the things that's sort of, you look at the team and you look at the lineup and the way things, Travis Green is using his guys, and he's talking a lot about getting his forwards up ice quickly, getting the puck out, moving the puck out of the trouble areas. And you know, think about one guy specifically that has changed that whole dynamic. Think about, it's not just that they've added Mike Delzato, but that he was put in the hole where they got the addition by subtraction by getting Lucas Spezza out of the lineup.
Yeah.
And that's just been such an example of what this team has been able to do, in that they're able, in the end, push the puck up the ice. And they're not taking tons of shots, but they're not giving away tons of shots either. It's working. And I, unlike other teams, I think this is actually could work. I mean, they're still not clearly a playoff team, but they're getting there.
Yeah, no, 100%. So, you know, you look at the things that should suggest success is sustainable. Do they have a clear identity? Yeah, I think that's fair. Four-line team plays up tempo, pressures up the ice, you know, defense is active. You know, that's something they just didn't have under Willie Desjardins, whether it was the players he was given or whether it was his coaching. But so tick that box. The other thing is you can't really say one guy has carried the team or one guy is. Maybe Derek Dorsett is playing like miles over his head. I don't think anybody, you know, penciled him in for 30 goals this year. But, you know, they've had two significant injuries on the blue line. Their third highest paid player has been out of the lineup. Now, we can argue if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But again, it's all kind of, you know, in these first 15 games, it's kind of reflected the hurly-burly of the NHL regular season. So you can't say, you know, they've been lucky, or it's been a schedule, or they've had these crazy wins like they did last year. To me, it's a reflection of their overall game, and that's one of the things that's encouraging.
Did you see the list of goal scorers behind Derek Dorsett?
No.
But here, let's go. Connor McDavid, TJ Oshie, Wayne Simmonds, Ricard Raquel, Max Pacioretty, Blake Wheeler, Phil Kessel, Taylor Hall, Patrick Kane, Sidney Crosby, Nathan MacKinnon, Leon Draisaitl, Joe Pavelski, Jacob Voracek, Corey Perry, and Artemi Panarin.
Yeah,
that's
awesome. Yeah. What's he got? Seven?
Seven goals. Seven
and 12 is his career high.
12 is
right?
his career yeah. high. Seven is his yeah. second best, which he got his first season here with the
yeah.
Canucks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, talk about a guy that's just riding all the waves.
No, I've said this all along. The important stat for him at the end of the season isn't going to be goals, because right now the Canucks are playing with house money.
Mm-hmm.
It's how many games he played,
right.
because he really does give them an element that they've been lacking. And I would submit that Eric Gudbranson is kind of the defensive version of him. They're not analytical darlings, and I understand the problems people have with the game. But hockey hasn't evolved that far where guys with that grit and competitiveness and toughness aren't a help, especially on this team. I've just saw too many games in the last 2 years where they were pushed out of games. And I haven't seen that yet this year. So again, another thing that's encouraging.
Gudbranson is an interesting question because, contract up, lots of chatter now. What are the Canucks going to do with him? Because, you know, realistically, he seems to be in probably the role he's best suited to, but he seems, you know, the story goes, he may want a lot of money. And that doesn't seem like the kind of contract you need to be adding to this roster in the role that he's playing.
I don't think he's going to win it in arbitration.
Right.
I don't think he can. But I look at, I'm sorry, I'm going to be cribbing from Lawrence Gilman here, but I think Carl Alsner is a pretty good comparable.
Right.
And so I think if Eric is thinking anything more than 4.5, 5 at the right. outside, and, you know, for an unrestricted free agent, I think, you know, that's reasonable. I think anything beyond that, if he can get that in the open market, God bless him.
Yeah.
You know, he'd take it. But he is kind of an important player for the Canucks in the grand scheme of things. And he's still young enough that he's part of the plan going forward. He's not, you know, I know when they made the deal, there was a lot of debate about, you know, is this a for futures? Is this a now? It's like they're trying to win now, which is kind of the debate which has framed the Benning organization, which I think we'll get to in a little while. But yeah, a real interesting one there.
You know, looking at the rest of the lineup, I mean, it's so interesting. I mean, I've been listing the Sedins as the fourth line. They're mm-hmm. playing fourth line minutes. And I think that sort of transition was sort of a shock. I don't know if people have necessarily settled into it, but it's something that's happened. I mean, obviously, Henrik finally, you know, got his first goal of the season the other night. You know, do you think that carries forward? Is that how they end up carrying on for the rest of the season, that they're kind of the guys that are playing a bit on the power play and then sort of being spotted minutes here and there where they can take advantage of the other team?
Yeah, you know, and I know coaches say this all the time, that, you know, that number is almost meaningless in that, especially on this team. Second, third, fourth line, whoever. Because I think on any given night, if somebody's going, they're probably going to end up getting second line minutes. And I think that, you know, the Sedins and whoever they're playing with would fit into that. But I think that's fine. They're still capable of changing the momentum of a game with one of their crazy shifts or a big goal or something like that. And we've seen that in the last two games they played, Daniel scoring the goal to get them back up in the game against Detroit. And then, you know, Henrik in really a textbook piece of Sedinery. So it's a nice thing to have in the back pocket. And it's past the point where they're depending on it. So it's like they've been weaned off the Sedin. So, you know, almost again, whatever they get from them this year offensively is going to be gravy. And if they can, you know, contribute in that 45 to 50 point range for the minutes they're getting, I don't think they'll get there, but boy, that would be pretty good.
What in the end is this a sign of? I mean, this is something that we've been warning about for a long time. You know, how will the Canucks survive their post-Sedin universe? You know, we're sort of seeing the beginning of that now. We've seen the Horvat line step up. We've seen Brock Besser. The first 20 NHL games of Brock Besser have been fantastic. You know, what is this team? Where is this team at? Where are they trying to go at this point?
Yeah, I think it's a sign that the plan has envisioned by the Lyndon Benning management team is starting to come into focus. And I think you can look at it and see where this team is going to be 2 or 3 years from now. And again, I keep using that word, but I think that's a lot more encouraging for Canucks fans than to have two 37-year-old players who are clearly on the downside of their career leading the offense, getting the bulk of the, you know, the power play time, all the sugar minutes. I think they can look at it. To me, Bo Horvat's taken another step this year, and where I see it is in his puck distribution. he's still not, you know, like a grade A playmaker, but I mean, before this year, it was kind of head down, drive to the net, something good might happen. He's made some plays this year too, and the guys he's playing with, and I think having the shooter on that line and Besser, I think that's facilitated that. So, you know, this is going to be really interesting for me where Horvat ends up this season point-wise, because for me, he's bare minimum, he's that 50-55 point, good, really good second-line guy. Now, if he can get into that 75-point range, 65, 75, all of a sudden he's Patrice Bergeron, and that's a whole different level of player. That's somebody you can build a winning team around.
I guess my question from that standpoint, though, is, you know, okay, so their vision is coming together. Why did it take so long? I mean, I think back, right? You know, I mean, the owner goes on the radio on Tuesday and had an interview with the 650 guys and said, there are no shortcuts. And all I could sit back and think about was, you know, I think it was Jim Benning's first press conference when he says, I think this is a team we can turn around quickly.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's taken them 3.5 years to kind of come around on the fact that, you know, I mean, I hate bringing it up, but this is supposedly what Mike Gillis was arguing for the whole time, was that it's time to turn the page, and it's taken 4 or 5 years to do that. Why did this take so long for this to kind of finally settle in?
I think there are, as is often the case, there's no easy answer to that. I think there's a multiple of factors involved there. And I think when they took over, I think they somehow thought they could talk Ryan Kesler into staying. And when you add Kesler to that core group, that probably is the makings of a team that, you know, should have been competitive. So, you know, that's one thing. I think the second thing that jumps out for me is they're just so terrible at messaging. I mean, it was pretty clear to me that, you know, the direction they were going, but they still hung on to this fallacy that, you know, we can be competitive. So every move they made was viewed through that lens, through that prism. And I think that's why they were held accountable for so many of those trades. There's a little distance now. So, for instance, you know, we can just tick off the players. Remember, you know, the hue and cry over the Dorsett contract.
Right.
Crazy, insane. And at the time, it probably was. Well, now that he's a contributing player at the dollars he's at, not bad. Brandon Sutter, I mean, we can argue back and forth about that contract. But he's still a shutdown center you can throw out who's getting 18 minutes a night playing against the other team's top line. And he's really, for me, as important as any forward in the lineup. Again, now you're starting to see the integration of the younger players, which is, you know, something they've talked about all along. But those are the things that really jump out at me. And to be honest, yes, too many of their moves were made with the win now mentality. And I go back to their first big signing, Ryan Miller. The last thing that team needed was a veteran $6 million goalie. And it was made for one, that contract was signed for one purpose, to keep them competitive.
It was interesting. Miller, I think after yesterday's, Ducks practice talking to reporters, I think I saw a quote essentially saying, yeah, I went to Vancouver with a purpose and there was a reason why. And he's, you know, I'm sad I didn't deliver, but in the end, you know, didn't work out. And yeah, I mean, it was such a thing to think back about. And I remember as his window was closing last year, sitting there thinking, you know, Ryan Miller is going to be one of the best goalies this team has ever had. And he'll just be this complete kind of side note on the history of the Canucks, which is unfortunate because, you know, I know you've spoken to the sort of the quality of his character before and what a, you know, good person he was, an interesting person to talk to and what a performer he was. And now, so of course, you know, tonight, I mean, we're recording this before the Ducks game. So, you know, who knows how that goes, but yeah, it's such a strange way to view. I mean, it was such a strange period when you look at it through the Miller window. And then of course you can add in the Erickson contract, which, you know, Louis Erickson's a very good hockey player, but it's, you know, you look back a year and a half now and it remains unclear to me why this was a player that made any sense for them to add.
It was, they were going all in for Lucic. That was the guy Benning was so horny for. That was the guy he desperately wanted. And, you know, and when the opportunity to play with McDavid in Edmonton came up, that was it. But it was like they couldn't flip the paradigm and move on to somebody else. They were just bound and determined to spend that money. Now, it would be nice if Louis Erickson delivered on a bit of that. So what does that look like? I mean, can he just be another piece of the puzzle? Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably be a reasonable expectation. I will start believing in this team, I will tell you, and I've said this before, so I'm just going to say it. I'll start believing in this team when Alexander Burmistrov is playing a lot smaller role than he's playing now, like maybe one in the press box. I just, you know, for me, he's a 26-year-old guy who's never done it offensively, and he's being asked, like, I mean, he's centering two pretty good offensive players, right? This team, they just can't afford to have that dead weight in that spot. Yeah. So that's something, with Erickson coming back, and I know they're going to have to, you know, rejig things, but to me, it screams Marcus Granlund going back to center.
Yeah, or, I mean, even interestingly enough, moving, you could see a scenario where Erickson's on one wing, Vanek's on the other, and Gagné's in the middle. And then all of a sudden, that's kind of an interesting NHL second line. Yep. You know, yep. I mean, those are guys that know how to play. That's going to be interesting. Let's shift our gears a little bit to looking at the rest of the NHL, but it's still Canucks related from my standpoint. Alain Vigneault, who's now been 5 years in New York, which seems stunning to me, is at 200 wins.
Yep.
And it's kind of amazing to look at how things went for him in the Big Apple and then remember the Canucks are now on their third coach since he left.
Amazing. And I know, like, this year, I mean, he has supposedly been coaching for his job for the last two weeks, but they've rattled off, I think it's 5 wins in a row
that's
now.
That's right, yeah.
He is a funny cat. For whatever reason, he gets his teams to play for him. And I'm sorry, it's just, you know, you just look at the record. And yes, he's always had a good goalie. And yes, he's, you know, he's had pretty good teams. And no, he hasn't, you know, delivered the big prize. But season in, season out, he just seems to deliver. And I think, really, that's the only measuring stick you can apply. In this case, is it not? I mean, do you break it down and this guy did this or this guy didn't do that? I think that's kind of immaterial.
I know the classic kind of valuation was how many cups does he have? But, you know, now in a 31-team universe, it's hard to win the Stanley Cup. But I find myself wondering, I mean, Alain Vigneault, I don't even know what the total would be, but he's got 1,000 wins. I don't know how many wins he has.
Well, winning this coach in Canucks history, and I'd be really curious to see where he falls in Rangers history. Yeah. Like I would hazard a guess to say he's got more wins than Keenan. It's, you know, I'm probably thinking Emil Francis is the franchise leader, but you know I'd be shocked if he isn't in the top four or even the top three.
And so as a result of what I come to is he a Hall of Fame coach?
That's a really good question. I think without the Stanley Cup on his resume, probably not. And if he isn't, then he has to have like a crazy long career that goes he's in Montreal. He had the 7 years here. So he's looking about year 13, 14.
He's at year 16.
Year 16, yeah.
He's got 622 career wins. So overshot the mark a little bit there.
His first year of coaching the Habs was the year I worked in Montreal.
Okay.
And it was really interesting on a number of different levels. One of them was Red Fisher, the dean of hockey writers in Canada, had this policy that he didn't talk to rookies. This is a reporter.
Red Fisher didn't talk to rookies.
So he didn't talk to the coach the whole year because he was a rookie. He was a rookie. And they actually had a pretty good team that year. And they ran into Dominic Hasek in the playoffs when Hasek was at his peak. And if memory serves, it was the second round, and I think Buffalo swept them. But it was as impressive a goaltending performance as I've seen over 4 games. Hasek in that series, he was incredible because that Buffalo team was terrible. Like their best player was Mike Pepp. They had Mike Pepp, Alexei Zitnik, and a lot of guys like Dixon Ward, and they made it to the Stanley Cup final. It's amazing.
That 97-98 Canadiens, Recchi, Domfus, Koivu, Corson, Ruchinski. I mean, the top 6-7 names, Malakhov, Brian Savage, Patrice Brisebois, you know, like that's a really solid core group of players.
Yeah.
You can see why.
Was Trevor Linden on that team?
I think that was the year before played. Yeah. So
No, like I said, there was great hope, and they had a really funny goaltending tandem, like Jocelyn Thibault and Andy Moog, I'm thinking.
You got it.
How about that? So that was my first experience with with Vigneault, but also at the time, like, I was like a freelancer and I didn't really have a whole lot of clout in that Montreal market.
Did Red talk to you? I mean, you would have been a rookie in Montreal.
No, I wasn't a rookie in Montreal, but I had been. So what you, that would have been about my 10th year covering the NHL. Okay. So he did deign to talk to me. Actually, I've always had a good relationship with Red. He's a fascinating character.
I do miss his appearances on the Hockey Night in Canada Hot Stove, as he'd sort of whine some incredible story because he just knew everything.
Yeah, and I understand his health is, he's hanging in there.
He's 100 and something, isn't he?
His health isn't, I don't think he's quite that old yet. And he wouldn't do it as a matter of course, but every now and then he'd hop into the time machine and tell you a story about
Toe Blake.
About Doug Harvey picking him up because they wanted to go to this camp for kids in the Laurentians, and they spent the day painting cabins. A little different era. I think also, I'm pretty sure this is true. I think the Canadians paid his travel expenses back in the 50s.
Okay. 91. I've overshot the mark again. He's not 100. He's 91.
Yeah,
so.
There you go.
Let's stay with the Habs. What the heck is going on there? I mean, something's got to be wrong with Carey Price. I mean, he just doesn't seem himself. You know, they're getting good shots off. I still think they're too much team chaos, and I think you know, sort of the top, and that comes from the top. But
yeah, for me, they're just a top heavy team. They've got like three or four absolute frontline players. Yeah. Whether it's whether it's Price, whether it's Shea Weber, they've got some nice forwards, but there's like zero depth in the lineup.
Yeah.
Especially, and that seems to be the model. And that's, I'm sorry to just to double back to the Canucks here. It seems the teams that are doing well are those teams that are legitimately, right. 12 deep at forward or 9 deep and can throw, another lineup. And, you look at the teams that are doing well, whether, that's Tampa for me.
Yeah. To a lesser extent, you can say the Jets are in the same story. I mean, we just saw the New Jersey Devils. I mean, they're maybe punching a bit above their weight, but another team that's got a nice solid rotation of forwards.
Yeah, and it's funny because, this conversation we have about the Canucks, is their success sustainable? We could probably apply that to about a dozen teams right now, because the NHL standings right now are a little irregular. Winnipeg, are they New Jersey? Yeah, you're right. There's a whole bunch of teams. Is Washington going to suck all year? Is Chicago going to be average? Is LA going to keep it up? I didn't see that one coming.
And I mean, you look at the way the NHL is set up, and in many ways, this is kind of what they want, which is that you're going to have four or five truly dominant teams. A couple of those teams that we expected to be dominant haven't been so far. And so you look at like Edmonton, who are going to have to punch themselves into the playoffs from way back, mm-hmm. given everything. And, you have to wonder what the mood is like there. And you kind of wonder if things are going on back behind the scenes that are perhaps speaking to why they're having difficulty. This is the league that the NHL really wants, is that everybody's kind of in it, and the Canucks are going to feel like they're kind of in it, and they've got some questions to look at, I think, going down the line. And I think you actually said it, I think with Chappie recently, it's like they cannot go for it. They have to sit back and stick with the plan. But yeah, I mean, I look at the Jets, I look at how well they're doing. A lot of people pick the Flames to be doing better than they are. And I mean, the Flames, I think, are maybe kind of turn the corner. Of course, they lost the Canucks this week, so maybe that blows up that theory. And then, of course, there's the Vegas Golden Knights.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I saw that one coming. Yeah, 100%. And if I could name you I can name you three of their players. But, another team that's in that kind of nice early season story. Let's talk again in February to see where they are. Yeah. Further to your point about parity, I mean, we can argue about its, the impact of the entertainment value of the game. You can't argue it's bad for business in the NHL because as long as teams can sell that we're in the playoffs, we're playing meaningful games, that's the best possible case scenario. And really that's kind of what the NFL has built a lot of its brand on.
Let's shift gears here before we go a little bit. I mean, you've been the Lions guy so much this year. What went wrong? Have you kind of landed on one particular thing, what is Wally's future? I mean, I looked at those quotes from Monday and it sounded like, first of all, clearly a guy who didn't have a whole lot of fun, and you can understand why, and a guy who clearly doesn't necessarily know what he's going to do next year.
I don't see David Braley saying he's going to own the team another year without Wally coming back. I just don't see it. I might be wrong. I might be reading the tea leaves wrong there, but, and that seems to be the consensus opinion too. Wally will be back for another year, but this isn't a healthy situation. It's not healthy for the franchise. I don't think it's healthy for Wally. It's certainly not healthy for the fan base. I mean, that team was running on fumes by the end, and sitting there in BC Place, you could just feel that, just like the energy seeping out of the dome. There was no excitement. There was no fire. There was no, you know, sense of all those things you go to live sporting events for. It wasn't there. And to think it might be improved next year. Now, of course, the wild card in all this is if Jonathan Jennings gets back to that franchise quarterback, it's all about the quarterback in the CFL. If he does that, the kind of game he plays, he might be able to light a fire. And I still don't think they're that far away. And you never really are in the CFL. It's getting lucky with a couple of players. It's getting some momentum and, you know, and then you're turning a corner. But this really has the potential to be a disaster. As bad as this year was, it could be even worse next year. And that's an incredible thing to say.
What happens if Jennings, you know, I mean, you know, reports this week, I guess Rick Dhaliwal saying that, you know, he's been talking to the Vikings and the Packers. And, you know, obviously, oh, coach, the NFL, you know, you can't help but say why not? I mean, even just being at training camp, you're going to make more money than the alternative. So, you know, what if Jennings kind of gets some kind of tangible offer and finds himself involved with an NFL team, you know, through the end of training camp next August, and all of a sudden the Lions don't have him and Travis Lule is trying to recover from a devastating knee injury. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't clearly have anybody else to hand the keys to.
Kevin Glenn. Kevin Glenn is the answer to that question for the CFL. No, 100%. I mean, I don't see Jennings as an NFL quarterback, and given the season he had,
it's hard to see.
Who's going to go to bat for him? Yeah. So would he want to hang? Would he want to go through that, you know, that NFL rinse cycle that so many players seem to be caught up in?
I think the money makes it worth it.
I understand that, but CFL quarterbacks, that position pays well
That's fair.
And he'd probably still be. Even coming off the season, I'm guessing he'd still be in the 350 range.
Right.
So, you know, that's enough. But what's better for him, to play in a league that's pretty good at developing quarterbacks, or to go and hold a clipboard or be a training camp arm or being, you know, run the practice team?
Yeah, because he's not going down there to back up anymore.
No, that's just it. Yeah. You know, and then, you know, whatever else he is, he's still, you know, a smallish guy from Saginaw Valley State, and I don't think any personnel guy is going to hang their reputation. This is our man. Yeah. This is the guy we want. So I think, you know, if he comes back, and he's still young enough, if he comes back, puts together two really solid CFL seasons, then I think the NFL becomes a viable alternative, but not now. But this is also presupposing he gets back to the, you know, the form he had in 2016, and he continues from there. And I am at a loss to explain it, other than, you know, he got hurt. He lost a bit of confidence. It just, you know, and then things snowballed from there. I think the organization has to take some of the blame. I think you have to look at Kahari Jones and his role in this, because once it started to go south at Jennings, it just didn't seem like anything could be done to stop it and, you know, and get him on a footing where he could move forward. But that becomes job number one next season.
And, of course, the Whitecaps, you know. I mean, burned brightly for a time, then kind of hit the wall. I mean, I you know, they played a system that I had said it very, you know, quite early on, said this might get you the playoffs, but it's not going to – you're not going to beat a team like Seattle who sort of invite you to come at them. And, if you know, if they don't even have a trap for you to try to set, there's nothing you can do. And, you know, Carl Robinson this week said, yeah, absolutely, there's going to be a lot of changes. And, you know, it's tough to see David Oestedt go, but sports is a business, and you can't, in the end, especially in a salary cap league, afford to be sentimental. And so, you know, I think it's kind of surprising to me to see people being shocked that he's definitely out the door. I mean, we knew this for a while.
Yeah.
So, you know, the Whitecaps, again, I mean, I think a bit further ahead, I think, than the Lions are in terms of setting themselves up for next year, but still have to do a lot of convincing, don't they?
Well, yeah, and again, you know, I kind of look at, to me, the Portland series in 2015, the Seattle series in 2017, two chapters from the same book. And what it told me was they're either not spending enough on players or their players aren't good enough.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are two top drawer MLS teams. Yeah. You know, they were both Portland League champion, Seattle defending league champion, right. But you can't really say that they were towering above the other teams.
No.
It's probably a mix of about four or five teams. But that's what I saw in both cases, and it just seems to be drummed in with regularity that, you know, they're kind of good enough to play a system, as you said, that would get you into the playoffs, but they just lacking that difference maker, that one or two guys, whether it's Clint Dempsey or, you know, the guys they had in Portland. But I mean, that's what showed up in that series. Now, I thought Rania might have been that guy. And when he went into the lineup in July there, he changed things. He gave them, especially on the counterattack, because he just seemed to thrive in that role. So I just hope he was hurt, because he gave them zippity-doo-dah going back to the Portland game.
Yeah.
And even the game where they scored five goals against San Jose, he wasn't particularly noticeable. And then, again, Claude Rains, the disappearing man against Seattle. So the invisible man, rather. That's the guy. I mean, he was the guy that, you know, Robinson was saying this might be the best player in franchise history. So he's got to be that guy. He's got to be, you know, he's got to be the man in form, and he's got to do it over the life of a season. And then we'll see. And I think there's some, I'm not sure where Freddie Montero is, but, you know, he's got an awfully big ticket for a franchise that isn't, you know, all that enthusiastic about spending money. I just wonder if he'll be back next year.
Well, he was the big sort of question mark this week. And, there were some questions about him because technically he's under contract with a Chinese club. Mm-hmm. Like the rest of the Chinese league has, you know, sort of said, well, we can't have this many foreigners anymore. And so that's kind of why the Whitecaps were able to get him. So now the question becomes, can the Whitecaps, you know, basically make a permanent signing of him, mm-hmm. or can they arrange a loan again or something? I mean, I think Montero's enjoyed his time here. I think mm-hmm. he liked being here. It was a reasonably familiar place. You know, I mean, met his wife in Seattle. Seattle was his home for a long time, and it's close enough. And, you know, Canada's a nice place. And, you know, I think he was a guy that, you know, obviously I didn't get to cover the team a lot early in the year, but as I kind of got to come out a bit more later in the season, you know, I mean, I saw him early on and he didn't have a whole lot to say, but as the year went along, he got a lot more interesting to talk to.
It really is an interesting character. And, you know, you're talking about Reyna, but to me, the partnership he had with, you know, Montero is such an intelligent player, able to read off him, you know, and to get, you know, the space he created, he was able to exploit that. And, you know, again, he's probably no better than an above average MLS striker. But when it was really cooking with Rain, it looked like they could be difference makers for this team.
Yeah.
That's why it looked like a little different Whitecaps team for me until they got exposed against Portland in the last regular season game and then against Seattle in the playoffs.
All right, Ed, we should wrap it up. But before we go, I will note that you basically arrived, I think it was a year before the Sedins were drafted. Is that right?
Yeah. Were they 99?
99.
Yeah, 98, 99 was the first year.
So just to confirm, you are not feeling like a fourth liner yet, are you?
No. Well, yeah. Well, you know, I want to say a valuable fourth line. a fourth liner with third line value.
There
I
you
think
go.
That's me.
Good in the room. All right, folks. He's Willis on Sports on Twitter. I'm at Rising Action. We'll be back next week. Hopefully, Mr. Chapman will be out of sick bay and ready to go. You can find us on Stitcher. We're on TuneIn. Just search for Problem Sports. We're on